So I'll be taking a step backwards here in science. We're going to go back to the linear theory of dynamos, and I've been asked to sort of review for you some of the subject of fast dynamos, and that's what I'll try to do. And I mentioned a few collaborators here that go back over a number of years. There are many others that are here, some of them here in this room that have contributed to this theory. I'll try to talk about the following topics. First of all, the definition of a fast dynamo, sort of formally, why study it, some properties of fast dynamos, examples, just to show you fast dynamo action in action. I'd like to spend a little time discussing how one can, in some of these models, now remember still in the linear theory, try to make a comparison between the sort of deterministic generation of magnetic field that comes out of these examples with the so convinced the classical sort of alpha effect picture we've been hearing about. And I have here dynamic equilibration. That's a subject of discussion today. I will not be saying much about that because of we have a number of others who will cover this, and we'll be discussing it this afternoon, I think. I would, however, like to put the my presentation in the sort of perspective here. This is sort of the phase space that we're interested in magnetohydrodynamics, and the place we really want to be is this sort of nonlinear saturated regime here, where we really do just have MHD turbulence, and this is sort of an attractor in this phase space, if you like. And where I'm going to be situated is down here, where B is very small and there's some motion occurring that we can then take to be known. The reason it can be taken to be known is because the field here is so weak it can't change the field yet. So it's an artificial situation which allows us some leeway in dealing with the motions themselves, and therefore it gives us some chance to get some idea of how magnetic fields and motions interact. That's sort of the idea. Now, this is, let me go over something we're all familiar with, just very briefly. Because I just want to introduce some of the ideas that are emphasized when you start taking this goal of looking at a fast dynamo. The induction equation now, of course, we're treating as linear, therefore the velocity field is given, and the magnetic Reynolds number is going to be taken to be extremely large, and this is the key assumption of the whole theory, of course. It introduces a very difficult singular problem. We all have to deal with it. We should keep in mind, though, that the object of this exercise, if you like, is going to be to try to assess how the advection terms act on the field in the presence of some kind of smoothing operation here that we're calling diffusion. And one of the things that a theory should try to do in this case, I think, is to be relatively insensitive to what this term actually is. But I'm going to be talking always about standard diffusion. But in fact, you can imagine other physics, and somehow you would still like it to be applicable, this theory to be applicable. So that's one of the motivating ideas, is to try to, and we'll see later, that. But that means it's sort of the old picture of taking the term that you would like to somehow be treating in a robust way, forgetting it's even there, and then asking yourself, can you somehow develop a theory that encompasses what happens with this term? In other words, the important effects of diffusion are included. Now, you can make a comparison with, say, Prandtl's boundary layer theory as a way of including viscosity in an otherwise inviscid theory, but there's a perfectly good inviscid airfoil theory that has its own use. So we're after that airfoil theory, if you like. Now, the formal definition of a growth rate is we take the logarithm of the magnetic energy, and we look at this for a linear problem. We can look at this growth rate as a function of the magnetic Reynolds number. And, of course, a dynamo is something that has a positive growth rate. That's the term that we normally use for that. Now, you can study this problem classically as an eigenvalue problem, and one typically considers either steady motions or time-periodic motions. This is because there's really very little known about eigenvalue problems outside of these two cases, in fact. I mean, mathematically, it's hard enough for the periodic case. But, of course, one might consider a wider range if you were so inclined. Now, formal definition of a fast dynamo is that the a limit of this growth rate as the magnetic Reynolds number goes to infinity should be positive. Now, I want to emphasize very much that although we're sort of interested in getting rid of diffusion is very much a part of this problem. It is a very key part of the problem. And it comes up not only here where we insist on it being taken as a limit over problems with finite dissipation, but also when we try to imagine what equilibration occurs later. That's a nonlinear problem. But certainly here we also have to include it. So we formally define this on the basis of the effects, however small they may be, of diffusion. Now, here are some properties. Now, let's get to these fast animals and what they look like. But here are some properties that is listed here. We tend to find that if we have some smooth velocity field, that they're going to have chaotic Lagrangian structure. Okay. In fact, if you have a steady flow with no exponential stressing, then Vishik has proven that this is a slow dynamo. By the way, I didn't say that, did I? That a slow dynamo is a dynamo where the limit of the growth rate goes to zero. So I say it right here. Otherwise, the dynamo is slow. That's in the Lagrangian sense. Okay, so the energy in the field that we find developing in these fast animals is dominated by noise. This is one of the problems of even talking about them. And there's a related theory of large deviations that occur in statistical modeling. The mean field is very much smaller than the maximum field, and so I call it fibrillated for that reason. And we also then have the problem that in the limit of large magnetic Reynolds number, the dynamo can be localized to the length scales that are built into the velocity. And in fact, for a perfectly conducting bounded domain, Bondi and Gill showed a long time ago that you really can't get field outside of the domain. So you need some other mechanism. Then you're getting rid of the ability to diffuse it out. You've got to get it out some other way. Well, we all know the solar convection zone looks to be fibrillated and displays some of the properties that I'm talking about here. One would like to think that maybe there's a reason for that in the kinematics. Now, slow dynamos, yeah. The unsteady case is the easy case. I mean, that's where we get all the fast dynamos easily. You mean under what conditions does an unsteady motion produce a fast dynamo?
Well, Vishik's theorem, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, Vishik's theorem says the steady case.
Right. Oh, do you need exponential stretching of an unsteady? Do you need it for an unsteady? My guess is yes. Yeah, I mean, I think you need it. I don't think you can produce a fast dynamo without, even in the unsteady case, without the Lagrangian. But it hasn't been proved as far as I know. Okay, here's a slow. Sorry.
Isn't it obvious? I mean, the stretching of the field line has the exponential for the field to grow.
Yes, I guess it is. Yeah.
It's obvious, but I don't think it's proven.
Yeah. Some of the obvious things, yes.
A rumor that Vishik has proven.
Not yeah. Sure,
it's
bilateral.
No, but this is the question is a fast animal, though. Yeah, fair enough. Here's a slow dynamo, and a sort of archetype of a slow dynamo. It doesn't encompass all the kinds that you can have. In Keith Moffitt's book, you'll find a veritable zoo of nice slow dynamos. So this is one due to Ponomarenko, and it's simply a cylindrical sleeve turning in a conductor. This can be taken to be infinite if you like, but you can think of it as a finite device if you want. And what happens here, now you can imagine you might have a discontinuity of velocity and just have a solid body rotation of the sleeve, or you might define a continuous variation of the velocity across it. And you can consider both of these cases. And if you consider a continuous variation across this transition region to solid body rotation, then you get a slow dynamo. It's a slow dynamo because the field gets wrapped up into a sort of helical shape in a thin boundary layer. This is now thinking of large magnetic Reynolds number, remember. So it all is confined to a boundary layer. But in order to stretch out and supply this helical field, you have to diffuse the field in the boundary layer into the conductor a little bit. And this diffusion is necessary to keep the dynamo going. Otherwise, it runs down, and the growth rate is, in fact, R to the minus one-third for the continuous case. A peculiarity of this dynamo is that if you have a discontinuity, an abrupt discontinuity, then it is, in fact, formally a fast dynamo. It's a fact. But we don't like that as an example of a fast dynamo, so we'll look a little more carefully at that in just a second. An almost fast dynamo was established by Soward for a cellular flow that is sort of occupies a very prominent place. This kind of flow came out of a theory of periodic dynamos in the 60s and 70s, and Glenn Roberts did a careful numerical study of the dynamo action by it. And this cellular flow has it differs from the Ponomarenko dynamo in that there's stagnation points, or stagnation lines, if you like, in it. And there's a flow up and down these cells, and at the same time, they are eddies, and therefore there's a helical structure. And the helicity of the flow is the same in each cell. Now, this dynamo is nearly a fast dynamo. Its growth rate goes to zero as 1 over the logarithm of the logarithm of the magnetic Reynolds number. A very slow growth. And the reason it's coming close is because the fluid, as it moves around these corners, is coming close to a connection point here between two stagnation points. And it's in the neighborhood of these points that things happen that are generating field almost with a fast dynamo growth rate. Now, another arc type of fast dynamo action we've all seen is this stretch, twist, fold mechanism that goes back to Van Steen and Zeldovich, and it goes back even further, I believe, doesn't it, to Alphane, or is it Alphane? I believe Paul Roberts had some comments on this. Anyway, it's a very simple idea, of course. You take a donut, you stretch it, you turn it over, you put it back on itself, and lo and behold, you've stretched the field by a factor of something, two, and you've given yourself back field more or less aligned the same way, so everything looks very good. And in fact, it's a nice thing to sit and ponder, you see. What's going on here? How would this be embedded in a larger domain? And does it really describe what we have in a typical flow field? Probably not. In fact, there are a lot of difficulties with embedding this. Keith Moffitt has done some very interesting work on finding flows that actually do this sort of thing, and it's certainly a very conceivable way of performing the operations you need to amplify field on the scale of emotions. The only thing to comment on, though, is that this is probably too simple to represent what really happens in fluids. For example, you could imagine that these loops, rather than folding on themselves, are actually folding onto neighboring loops which are doing the same thing. And that makes it a little easier to do. And all it means is that you're sort of sharing flux between different domains. So there are lots of variants of this basic idea. And I'll try to come to that as we look at some examples. Now, a non-dynamo is also worth thinking about. We all have this in mind when we say that field is being built up, but nothing is really happening in average. Here is a slab of field that's being folded and folded again and is constantly increasing in energy as a result because it's being stretched before it's been folded. But there's no mean field that's being built up. The mean field across this is staying exactly the same. And in fact, this field will then go down to a scale which is of order 1 over the square root of Reynolds number before it begins to diffuse. And at that point, bingo, a puff of smoke, and we're back to where we started, essentially, until we repeat the cycle. So this is a way of working very hard to achieve nothing in the dynamo. And yet this is exactly when what we're talking about, if we're talking about this kind of scaling that we've already heard about this today, of 1 over the square root of the Reynolds number is the field that's being equilibrated. So I would call this a pretty bad case. In other words, if that's what dynamos really do, then we're looking at a pretty, you know, almost a worst case scenario. Although there is an even worse case where you work with tubes rather than sheets. I might have to add that. So the picture then is that we're putting energy in with this given velocity field on some scale. It's generating smaller scales. We hope that there's something happening that's going to cause flux amplification. And there's dissipation going on at some scale here associated with the diffusion that we have in the problem. And the thing is that this is all happening together, and in these problems we have an eigenfunction in which all this is going on simultaneously and everything is growing with the same growth rate, most of the signal being noise. Well, not in a formal sense. Well, all I'm saying, let me be clear, all I'm saying is that as I perform a motion on the fluid, we will generate in time smaller and smaller scales. I'm not thinking of energy at this point. Yeah, but I mean, eventually you have to agree.
Is this kind of equivalent to the Bachelor scale? Or
I'm sorry?
Is that the Bachelor?
Well, this is not a dynamical one. No, I'm talking about... This is a kinematic calculation. I think I'm just saying that the field gets produced on smaller and smaller scales in time until we get down to a scale where the diffusion terms act, and we're not. I'm applying forces to do this. I'm not talking about an energetic equilibration at all. At that point, the small scale magnetic field number is 1. Okay. I'm not with you there. I'm sorry about that.
This is one of the major questions, controversies, or discussion problems of this afternoon. I don't think it's absolutely crucial to this discussion.
The small scales here are growing in concert with the mean field. They're all growing at the same rate once an eigenfunction of the problem is established. This is a kinematic theory. That's all I can really say at this point. Now, I want to come back to this idea that we would like to take the perfect conductor and make that use the perfect conductor to study whether or not a given motion is a fast dynamo. See, the problem is we kind of throw away diffusion, and yet we know diffusion is very important for the definition of the fast dynamo. Therefore, how can we do this? Well, the idea is to... And this is a suggestion that was used by many people, and Fidenot sort of codified it as what they call the flux conjecture. Basically, they said, well, let's do the obvious thing. Let's integrate over a piece of the domain and get sort of an average flux, averaging over the smaller scales that have been generated by the dynamo. And let's follow the growth of that flux as it builds up in the dynamo process without then really concentrating on the small scales. Now, if you formalize that as sort of a projection, one can take a smooth test function of any kind you want that sort of acts as your filter and tells the world what you're going to call a large-scale magnetic field, basically, and will filter out stuff smaller than that. And whatever that filter might be, then, you can introduce a growth rate based on that filtered field. And so this generates another number, gamma zero, and we have this little gamma zero coming from the definition of the fast dynamo, and so the flux conjecture says that this little gamma should be equal to this big gamma. If indeed this is the right way to go to sort of measure growth using the perfect conductor only. Well, because it could very well be that a dynamo, you don't know in advance what scale the dynamo is going to produce, and so therefore you'd like to, or what the symmetry of the correct eigenfunction is, so therefore you'd like to multiply by various f in order to find the one that works. Well, yeah, I mean, it's just smooth scalar fields, right? Complex valued. And this actually happens because you'll find certain configurations will give you dynamos of a certain symmetry. If you don't use that symmetry in the filter, you're not going to see it. So you really have to do that. Now, we then give some definitions, and just to give you an idea, this is not essential to anything else, but I just want to let you know that there's something called a perfect dynamo where this thing is positive, and it may not be the same as little gamma zero. I mean, it need not be to be a perfectly good fast dynamo. And so we call a fast dynamo non-diffusive if this thing is bigger than or equal to that, and if it's the other way around, we call it diffusive. Now, in that Ponomarenko case, which was a fast dynamo, because it had a discontinuity, this gamma zero turned out to be zero, and yet you have a gamma, little gamma zero. And so this is an example of a diffusive fast dynamo, the Ponomarenko fast dynamo in this classification. So this was just a little technicality. It was a way of dealing with some of these cases that are sort of special. Now, another way to think of these things is to imagine this problem of getting a signal that from the perfect fluid case. It's a question you can think in terms of norms. In other words, if I take the growing magnetic field and measure it in various ways, I might find as the scales build up as the scales get small and the field builds up, I'm increasing the magnetic energy to a certain time, and this is where diffusion begins to act. And here's another norm based on the current. It might grow more rapidly. But at the same time, all the same time where diffusion begins to act, we know we're picking up our eigenfunction and everything has to grow at the same rate. So the question is there a norm that is a straight line all the way down? And that's what we hope is given by this filtering, that it actually gives us a measure of the field which goes right down, accurately predicting the growth rate. And here's an example of the flux conjecture in action, if you like, in which this is for one of the dynamos I'll be showing you in a second. It's a time-periodic dynamo of a special structure. This is the actual growth rate as a function of a wave number, which I'll again make clear a little bit later. And this is these are the measured values of the growth rate. I'm sorry, those are the... these light markers are the flux growth rate. That's using the filtering. So that's... and so just to... Once you have this picture, you can start making some conjectures, and just briefly, that every perfect dynamo, remember, that has this positive filtered growth rate, where you just don't even pay attention to diffusion, is in fact a fast dynamo. Any smooth, perfect fast dynamo is non-diffusive. That's another conjecture that is true in a lot of cases. And almost all flows are non-diffusive fast dynamos. In other words, if you take your average three-dimensional flow, it's going to be a fast dynamo. Of course, the fast dynamo is also, slow dynamos are also very nice creatures. I don't want to say that. But fast dynamos, it's a little bit bigger class. Yes, that almost all motions are slow dynamos, and that's been proven. So they're talking about a set of measure zero. That is not. Anyway, this is a little theorem, just to give you an idea that there is something that's been proven. For smooth, steady flow U, gamma zero is no greater than the maximum Lyapunov exponent. So this is something that you might very well have anticipated. Now, briefly, I'd like to give you some examples. How much time do I have, Michael? 15? Okay, we'll have to hurry. I'm sorry? Uh-oh. No. Perhaps I won't show this. Perhaps I won't show the video. Should I show the video? I'll just stop talking as soon as I... I'm sorry? That's called a mean wave, modulated wave dynamo, yes, with a plus helicity. These are the modulated wave dynamos. They are time-dependent flows with this structure. They have a velocity which is, notice, has three components, and there are two Beltrami waves, if I may use the term here. Their curl is in fact proportional to the velocity field itself, with a sign which may differ in one of these waves. That gives us the two parities of the field, if you like. And these can be chosen to be constants. And if we do that, we're back to our cellular flows that I've already showed you. If they are chosen, for example, to vary like this, Otami early on studied this sort of motion. You might want to study motions which are nearly these cellular flows. And in fact, that's what I want to show you a picture of. But the important thing to remember is that we're considering a very special geometry. It's two-dimensional in the space. In the velocity field, depends only on two spatial coordinates. The magnetic field, the z variable is introduced as a multiplier by separating variables. And this is that wave number k that I indicated earlier. And Russell, this is the cascade I have in mind of things to small scale. This is just in time. Okay. This is two-dimensional. Yeah, well, this is, yeah. Two and a half. And here is a picture, now I want to spend a second with this. This is a picture of an almost integrable, that is to say, almost cellular flow. And what's happened is the heteroclinic connections have been broken by the time dependence. And here you have an example where you can see the magnetic field tracking. I should say that without this time dependence in the pure cellular flow, you have a very thin boundary layer of the order of one of the square root of Reynolds number, and you can show that as you turn on the time dependence, this boundary layer begins to follow the heteroclinic, the chaotic web, the manifolds, the stable and unstable manifolds, which are emerging from one or the other of these two stagnation points. So what you're seeing here is a field which is tracking the unstable manifold as it collapses onto another heteroclinic connection. And so this is a nice picture of how this kind of theory can start to make connections between the geometry of the flow field and how the dynamo action occurs. What's going on here is that we're having stretching and folding from the manifold, and simultaneously there is shearing coming from the motions in the z directions that are going to take advantage of the k dependence of the magnetic field and bring into alignment field that would otherwise not be aligned. So this is the key point in most of these examples and provides the mechanism for dynamo action. I think I'll show you just a bit of this. Let me see, I'll start it here. That's not very bright. Well, this is a magnetic wave number 1,000. You don't have to go up too high to see the structures. And this is the waves have opposite parity, that is to say, opposite helicity. Very low resolution than this one, but you can get the mean. Now, I'm just starting out with a very weak random field, and you'll see the heteroclinic structure emerging as the field builds up and is being sensed by the color scheme I put into it, whatever it was. You'll see there's a flow field. There's a flow field that's periodic in time.
What variable is being?
I think it's one of the components of the magnetic field, and the color red, blue, those are opposite directions. And now you're beginning to see this is now one of those cells that's being perturbed, and here is the connections as this field is being stretched and folded. Now notice in this one, the phase change that are occurring here as these popped out. The shearing in the Z direction is producing alternate red and blue, so it's like it's shooting out red and blue bullets instead of a mixture of red and blue. See, it folds and then it shears. That's out of the board. That's the other component of the Beltrami wave in each case.
What's the fast dynamo?
This is the fast dynamo, yeah.
What's K and B?
Oh.
What large?
Two, I think. But
that's large.
This is going backwards, I think. I think I'll stop this, if you don't mind. There's a lot more to it, but I think it gives you the idea. Yeah.
It looks as if the volume of space and the field is non-zero. It's greater than 10% of maximum level. Actually, we shrink to zero as the magnetic balance number goes to infinity.
Well, the magnetic... The chaotic web itself does not have that property. No, its thickness depends upon the amplitude of the time-dependent perturbation. So the moment you have the slightest bit of shaking of the manifolds, you have some chaotic web, and its thickness is not dependent upon the magnetic Reynolds number. That's geometrically imposed. So there's no way to turn on a fast dynamo slowly. You get it. The only thing you can do is sort of turn on a thin boundary layer of activity. Okay, I'll skip over a few things. I just wanted to indicate briefly a little exercise one can do. I mean, look,
Go ahead.
A brief exercise.
Okay,
a little exercise. When I was learning aerodynamics years ago, Wally Hayes always preached to us, be wise, linearize, because that's what one did then, you see. Every problem had to be linearized. So, Peter, don't you agree that it's not a bad idea? Anyway, in this linear problem, we can ask a few questions. For example, we can ask, supposing I do this in some well-defined way. I take one of my models, and I look at fast dynamo action, and I do whatever trick I can to study it in detail, then compare it to a classical alpha-omega model. In other words, build in what looks like to you like an alpha-omega situation, and then compare it to mean field theory. So that's what I'd like to report on briefly. This is some work with Andrew Gilbert and Andrew Soward. So we want to develop this. I think I just told you the idea. Let me just go on. Here, let me just show you the motion. It's really quite simple. Turn on a Beltrami wave, a single Beltrami wave. It's going to be in the same spirit as the flow you just saw. For a certain time, tau, that gives rise to what we call a Lagrangian map of three space into itself. This is because I'm thinking of the perfect conductor for the moment. We can later do this with diffusion turned on. But for the perfect conductor, we can actually think of it as a map. Then I apply a shear. So here is this omega coming in, which represents our omega effect. It's going to shear whatever we get from this motion. And we're going to apply this either together if we want to do simulations, or we can do it sequentially if we want to do calculations. And we can check these against each other. So the picture here is that you are deforming a magnetic field line into a helical wave by the two, the sine and the cosine, and there was an H multiplying the cosine, so that sort of gave us some control over the shape of this helix. And then it's being sheared by a shear in the Y direction, and these waves are being flattened out, if you like, the terms of the helix, and are producing a net field, as you can sort of gather from this little cartoon. So this is a sort of prototypical alpha-omega configuration in a fast dynamo context. Well, hopefully it is a fast dynamo. So here is then alpha-omega theory, and if I want to do a sort of first approximation to alpha omega theory, what I would do is to regard the whole process of turning on these two waves as decorrelated, one from another, and just introduce this tau sort of a correlation time, crudely speaking. This is not an exact science here, but I can compute in this way the alpha and this is the beta, the turbulent diffusivity. And so we have something to compare with. Now, I have at my disposal the K. The K is the same K as we had before, as giving us the Z dependence of the magnetic field. This is, again, I emphasize, a velocity field that's two-dimensional in the coordinates. And here is a comparison of the calculations with some diffusion and the alpha-omega model as a function of K. And as you expect, this is not going to be always good for all K, but it is perfectly good for smaller values of K. Well, this is still just a sort of very crude approximation to an alpha and an eta. So let me just summarize a calculation that was done in which we systematically compare the two models in the so-called anti-integrable limit, which Soward noted could be applied to this problem in 1993. This is where we turn on that wave for a long time, and it moves field particles a long distance compared to the wavelength of the wave. You with me? So that's called anti-integrable. It's a definite length scale that you can introduce, and you have a free parameter. It's a brilliant idea. And so here is the way you would formulate the eigenvalue problem if you assume that the model had an alpha and an eta. And here is the way the model really looks in this anti-integrable limit. Okay? And so we can just compare these two things. And we have then a precise way of saying we get the alpha-omega model. When this is true, we have two independent parameters. And this, by the way, this parameter here is very large in the anti-integrable limit. It breaks down when this happens, and then we have a very strong anti-integrable limit where it's its own beast. It has no comparison. So, I mean, I think this is the sort of exercise. I'm not saying there are a lot of assumptions here. We are dealing with a special flow. We're dealing with a special limit of that flow, and yet it is a context where we can answer some definite questions in a precise way. So that's one advantage of it, although I wouldn't pretend that this is anything like dynamical turbulence. Okay, I'll stop with that. Well, I wasn't aware of that. Thank you. I'd like to know the reference. The statement is made, there is a new theorem I didn't know about. And would you repeat that, please? There is a theorem that says the fast dynamo growth rate is one half the difference of... of the same sign. Yeah. Whose work is that? Is that your work? Well, I'm sorry, I didn't know about that. Yeah. Well, they can be, yes, I guess so, yeah. In what? Well, I'm willing to believe that. Oh, yeah. 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 All right. I can just say one word about that. I think I know what you're driving at, Elmer. My point in exhibiting the stagnation point region was simply to make contact with a classical problem of where chaotic structure is understood. Okay. Now, if you transcribe that same stretch, fold, shearing mechanism into a three-dimensional configuration. You don't, there may be stagnation points around, but it's no longer localized at the stagnation points. It need not be. This only really occurs near integrability in these models. And, you know, I really can't say what happens in three-dimensional in general, but I don't see any reason that stagnation points should be the center of activity. Is that what you were asking? That's a long story, and yes, it would be the first place these models would break down. I agree. Yeah. A few.
What is their overall relevance to understanding how Latin River
operate? Probably minimal, but I think there is a certain. I think the main use of the theory is to focus attention on how one might attack the problem of studying the limit of R going to infinity in some reasonable way. Using whatever method you have at your disposal. So there are a few methods that have been developed to answer, to deal with this linear problem. Whether there's something, a nonlinear version of this, I just don't know. I mean, we're talking about turbulence now, and, you know, that's another, but this is sort of like play turbulence. It's almost a place we can study some of these issues. And I would compare it, Yuri, to the current interest in the theory of turbulence in passive scalars. Completely kinematic problem.